Well, this is part two of the two-part series on faith that me and Pastor Mike McKendricks tag-teamed on. As he presented one dimension, I'm going to present the other, how many of us know that our God is multi-dimensional. The title of this message is called The Amazing Faith of the Atheist, and I kind of, before I get copyright infringement, I kind of stole that a little bit from Norm Geisler and Frank Turek's book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. So I gave them credit, and now I'll steal their ideas. All right. While Michael was talking yesterday about the irrational dimension of faith, scripture came into my mind while he was talking. It was in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 14. It says, "The man without the Spirit does not accept the things that come from the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. He cannot understand them because they are spiritually discerned." And so a lot of what we do as Christians, as followers of this unseen God, may seem quite irrational to those who, A, don't believe in God, or B, have a different picture of what God looks like. However, if the God that we believe in does indeed exist, as he is portrayed in the Bible, then obedience to him, even if it means doing crazy things like Ezekiel did in cooking his bread over cow crap to demonstrate a principle of God, even if it goes to that extreme, then obedience to these wild things happens to seem to be the most rational thing to do, because this is the God you're going to be facing on Judgment Day. And so I'm here to present the essential dimension of the rationality of the Christian faith and set it in the context of the amazing faith that you need to have to be an atheist. See, for the majority of human history, the question has not been, is there a God? The question has been, which God is there and how do we respond to this God? It's only fairly for the majority of human history, the atheists were on the fringe of society. It's a very, very small percent. And so only in the 20th century and a little bit before, with the work of Immanuel Kant and Bertrand Russell and the science work of Charles Darwin, do we see this exponential explosion of atheism. And what faith is the essence of faith in its philosophical form. Faith covers a gap in knowledge. Okay. Now, to illustrate this, we can take the example of Noah, which Mike used when he spoke. Noah had some knowledge, and he needed to exercise faith to fill in the gap of knowledge that he had to do an action. Once again, faith covers, if I have partial knowledge and I want to come to a distinct conclusion, then I need faith to bridge that gap. For example, in Noah's case, Noah knows God exists. That wasn't a question. His contemporaries knew that God existed but decided to act however they wanted to act. And then Noah heard distinctly from God that he was going to send a flood. And it happened to be that there was never an amount of rain at that point in time that would make that kind of a statement from God rational to Noah. But he indeed heard the word of God audibly, and Noah responded to it. He had a gap in knowledge in that it had never rained like this before. And so what Noah did was Noah responded in faith to cover that gap. So his response in faith to God was an action, okay, that was an action of faith, but it didn't hinge around the question of whether God existed or not. It was, how should I respond to this direct word from God? And so he stepped out and closed that gap with his faith. The same thing with Abraham. In the case of Abraham, Abraham's living in a small town of Ur, and he's commanded by God to relocate and to basically be a wandering nomad and enter into this promised land that would eventually he would be made into this great nation. And so he heeded the voice of God, and he entered into God's call by faith, but he already had some information. He needed to do was to use his faith to bridge that gap. God is speaking to me. I'm either crazy or I'm actually hearing from God. And if it is B, I'm actually hearing from God, I better go and put feet to what he's saying right now, or else it's big trouble for me. So everyone has faith. And when all the knowledge that we have is taken into consideration, it becomes obvious that atheist needs a whole lot more faith to believe what they do than the Christian needs for their belief in God. In other words, the atheist must cover a much larger gap in knowledge than the Christian does. In fact, the atheists have been known to violate several fundamental, extremely basic, and well-established laws of physics, mathematics, and philosophy in order to hold their atheism, in order to substantiate their belief that God does not exist. They violate three laws, and I'll explain these concisely. The law of causality, the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, and they violate the law of mathematical impossibility. Okay, these are blatantly, they take these laws and they say, okay, well, this is a law. We agree that this law exists. However, because my belief is limited to naturalism and the universe is a closed box that automatically rules out the supernatural, I am going to disregard these laws when they point otherwise. And I'm going to do so by faith. And when we see exactly the details of how they do this and the ridiculosity that kind of just emanates from their decisions, it becomes evident that you need a lot more faith, especially if you're informed. You need a lot more faith to be an atheist than you do to be a Christian. Okay, example number one, atheists violate the law of causality. From the law of causality says, and we got to be really careful on this one. The law of causality says that anything with a beginning in time must be created. Now we have to assert the beginning in time for the reason that if something is timeless, then it doesn't need to be created. And when we're looking in the search for God or ultimate reality, we're always looking for the thing that's the furthest back. Either the universe is timeless, or what made the universe is timeless, or if you're going to hold to the wacky theory of multiple universes, then the one who made the first universe is timeless. Okay? We know from science, and I'm not going to get into the boring details, but we know from science that the universe was created 13.7 billion years ago. Now, this is basically, if you're going to look at it from a scientific perspective, this is irrefutable. Irrefutable, what I mean by irrefutable is that it is past the realm of mathematical possibility for this not to happen. We know by the expansion rate of the universe, they actually have seen the galaxy seeds from the cosmic creation event that astronomers call the Big Bang. Okay? There is very little doubt in the mind of a rational scientist that the universe had a beginning in time. Yet, atheist astronomers and people who have this knowledge will violate the law of causality, will exercise their great faith violating this law of causality and say that, no, the universe created itself. Now, that is a big jump in faith for me. Okay, it didn't have a cause. This is the one thing they'll say that didn't have a direct cause. It came from nothing, and it exploded itself into something, and it did not need any input from an intelligent source or an unintelligent source, but it didn't need any input. And so a lot of atheists will take the next step and say, okay, well, if my universe can deny the law of causality, because your God can deny the law of causality. In other words, they'll ask the question, who created God? And your answer to the question, who created God, is simple. As I explained, God is timeless. He did not need to be created. He is outside of the dimensionality of the universe and therefore is the source of the universe and is not bound by time. The universe being bound by time, we've already established from science, it is 13.7 billion years old. It needed a cause. And since God has to be that cause, he is timeless, he is uncaused, and therefore he did not have to be created. All right, example number two. Atheists violate the law of entropy, which is the second law of thermodynamics. So the second law of thermodynamics, or the law of entropy, basically says that physical systems in this universe go from order to disorder. It's kind of, you can use the living room or the bathroom example. If you don't clean your bathroom, it's going to go from order to disorder. A tree out in a field will be born. It will grow up to full size, and then it will slowly go from order to disorder. We see this in animal species all the time as well. Ever since the Cambrian explosion, when we see 70 phyla of animals arriving on Earth, okay, which is basically all the phyla that we have in existence today, and all the millions of species that derive from that, okay, we do not see exponential new explosion of new species. Okay, we see some species arising here and there until the advent of man on what the Bible calls the sixth creation day. But it dwindles because the entropy law says that things aren't going to be ordered into higher order. Things are going to go down. And so there's no more dinosaurs. All the prebiotic or the postbiotic creatures that we see after the Cambrian explosion, all these creatures basically don't exist today, except for a few of them. Okay, but biologists, atheist biologists, will actually claim, they will make the radical claim that life not only spontaneously generates, but without any intelligent input, evolves itself into higher forms. This radically violates the law of entropy, and thus takes a lot of faith to make that claim. The third one, atheists violate the law of mathematical impossibility. Now, this might sound complicated, but it's actually very simple. Any number, any odds that are greater than 1 in 10 to the 40th power, which is 40 zeros behind the number 10, any number, any odds that are greater than that, 1 to the 50th power, are deemed mathematically absurd. And so, if, for example, as we see in the expansion rate of the universe, all the factors that have to come together for the universe to expand at the rate that it does fall into the, for that to happen by accident is 1 chance in 10 to the 180th power. Okay, that's mathematically absurd by far. However, atheist astronomers make the leap in faith and decide to go for that one part in 10 to the 180th power. That is absolutely ridiculous, and it takes a lot of faith to make that leap. On the biological level, with our cells, DNA in the cell, one strand of RNA, okay, which is basically a messenger, to explain it simply, the cell has a nucleus, and in the nucleus of the cell has the information to go out and make more cells. Okay, it's a very advanced you can think of it as a very advanced nanotechnological computer system. Okay, the chances of one strand of RNA, which is the coded little enzyme that you would need to go forth to make more cells, the chances of that coming together by chance is 1 part in 10 to the 60th power. Okay, now we already said 1 part in 10 to the 40th power is absurd. Okay, we're not even talking about a cell here. We're talking about just the information to make a cell. Okay, but they're going to go ahead and try to teach us that this did happen indeed by chance with no intelligent input whatsoever. Why? Because their base system of belief is not scientific at its root, but it's philosophically natural. In other words, their philosophy mandates that everything must have a natural cause. That's why you will see the textbook that says natural science. Okay? It means that the supernatural is ruled out in advance. So therefore, it's not a matter of if these odds are possible. Those odds have to be, it had to have happened because there is no possible supernatural explosion because this is science. And it takes a lot of faith to make that statement. In addition, atheists consistently disregard the odds of probability to believe what they do. Consider this. You have a 1 in 10 to the 8% chance of winning the lottery. Now, that doesn't fall under the realm of mathematical impossibility, but it is surely is improbable. Imagine gambling your life. What's up, Frau? How you doing? Now sit down and listen. Imagine gambling your life on the possibility that you would win the lottery. Okay, you got next week's lotto, you don't win, you're dead. Okay, imagine putting all your chips into that basket. Okay, that's what you would be doing by gambling your spirit or your soul, whatever, on the odds of 1 in 10 to the 8th power. Okay, all right, now check out the following biblical prophecies. These have been calculated exactly by Dr. Hugh Ross of Reasons to Believe. The probabilities of these three biblical prophecies coming to pass, each have been given a probability that is higher than winning the lottery. Now, lower than winning the lottery. Now, being an atheist, an educated atheist, you would know these prophecies. You would understand the historical background behind them, and yet you would bet against them coming to pass. The first one, in the 5th century BC, a prophet named Zechariah declared that the Messiah would be betrayed for a price of a slave, 30 pieces of silver, according to Jewish law, and also this money would be used to buy a burial ground for Jerusalem's poor foreigners. You can check that out in Zechariah 11, 12, and 13. Bible writers and secular historians have both verified this 30 pieces of silver as the sum paid to Judas Iscariot for betraying Jesus, and they also indicate that the money went to purchase a potter's field, used just as predicted for the burial of poor aliens. That was in Matthew 27, 3-10. Now, the probability of chance fulfillment in this case is 1 in 10 to the 11th power for that prophecy to be fulfilled by accident. For those atheists that would try to make the claim, oh, the book of Zechariah, this might have been a later addition to the book of Zechariah, we have the Septuagint that was compiled in 270 BC with this prophecy in it, along with Dead Sea Scrolls record. And so you have to understand as an atheist, okay, look, there's a probability of one chance in 10 to the 11th power that this prophecy in Zechariah is false. Okay, but I'm going to go ahead and bet my life that it is, because if it's true, chances are the Bible is the Word of God. Next one. I find this one actually kind of amazing. The exact location and construction sequence of Jerusalem's 9 suburbs today, the 9 suburbs in Jerusalem today, were predicted by Jeremiah about 2,600 years ago. He referred to the time of this building project as the last days. That is the time period of Israel's second rebirth as a nation in the land of Palestine. You can check that out in Jeremiah 31, 38 through 40. This rebirth became history in 1948, and the construction of the 9 suburbs has gone forward exactly, precisely in the location that the sequence predicted. Probability of chance fulfillment? One chance in 10 to the 18th power. That's 18 zeros behind the number 10 that could be an accident in the book of Jeremiah. Once again, the atheist puts all of his chips, all of his faith, on that one chance. Now, it is... It's not impossible. It could happen, but the odds are much lower than winning the lottery than it is. And to bet your life against it would seem like a foolish move. Last one. This is actually by Dr. Ross's and Associates' calculations. This is the lowest chance fulfillment of fulfilled prophecy in the Old Testament. And it's regarding how the prophet Moses foretold, with some additions by Jeremiah and Jesus, that the ancient Jewish nation would be conquered twice and brought into 2 captivities. There would be slaves each time, first by the Babylonians for an exact period of 70 years, and then by a fourth world kingdom, which we know now to be Rome. The second conqueror, Moses said, would take the Jews captive to Egypt in ships, selling them or giving them away as slaves to all part of the world. Both of these predictions were fulfilled to the letter, the first in 607 BC, and the second, as predicted by Jesus, in 70 AD. Further, the Jews would remain scattered throughout the entire world for many generations, but without becoming assimilated by the people or of other nations. Now, that means that the Jews would survive this dispersion, this captivity into these foreign nations without losing their essential bloodline. This doesn't mean that we don't have any mixed Jews. We do. I'm half Jewish myself. But the national identity of the Jewish people would not be completely corrupted. Then the Jews would one day return to their land of Palestine to reestablish for a second time their nation. And you can check that out in Deuteronomy 29, Isaiah 11, 11 through 13, Jeremiah 29, 11, 20, 25, 11, I'm sorry, Hosea 3, 4 through 5, and Luke 21, 23 through 24. This prophetic statement sweeps across 3,500 years of history and comes to its complete fulfillment in some of our lifetime. Who was around in 1948? Raise your hand. You didn't have to. I was just, anyway. So the chance of that happening by accident is 1 in 10 to the 20th. So you got one chance in 10 to the 20th of that prophecy happening by accident. And so the atheist really needs to apply an extraordinary level of faith once they have the knowledge that they have. And see, so with them, the issue is the more knowledge you gain, the more faith you need. And that's a bad formula for having faith in that direction, because faith is supposed to cover a gap in knowledge. Okay, if you're gaining knowledge and your gap gets wider, you have a problem. You might be believing the wrong thing. And so the atheist needs to apply an extraordinary amount of faith, do a whole bunch of mental gymnastics. Maybe the Septuagint wasn't real. Maybe this whole thing is a scam. Maybe Jesus actually slept with a woman and had kids. And maybe they grew up and did this. And maybe the Bible isn't really as it says. Maybe it's a whole scam by the Roman Catholic Church, which didn't come until the 5th century. You know, I mean, you're going to need to assert a lot. You're going to need to do a lot of mental gymnastics, a lot of mental maneuvering to kind of cover up this gigantic gap in knowledge. Blaise Pascal, we talked about him last time I was up here, made a famous wager, and it's called Pascal's Wager. And basically, to put it into short terms, he says, what do I have to lose? Speaking to the atheist, he says, what do I have to lose? If my God doesn't exist, I lead a good life, and then what? I find out that there's nothing at the end. Great. Not much to lose whatsoever. But what do you have to lose if God does exist? You live how you want to. You try to apply your faith to deny the existence of this God. And at the end, you end up facing him. So, it just doesn't even seem rational to pick B there. I mean, you pretty much, even if God didn't exist, even if our God didn't exist, it would be more rational to follow him, which is kind of weird, but anyway. A final example. This is the one that kind of sinks home most with me is the amazing faith of the atheists on the issue of human consciousness. Okay? Now, atheists claim that all life evolved from a primordial soup that was on the earth, say around 3.7 billion years ago. Okay, so we got this fishbowl on the condition of the early earth, and let's just go ahead, and science has proven that there's been no primordial soup. The oldest rocks on earth demonstrate that there are no prebiotic materials embedded in them, okay? We do not have what they thought that they had on the early earth, but let's just say that they did. Let's say that their soup existed, and magically there were amino acids in that soup, and they were floating around in that soup, okay? By accident, by chance, the atheists have it. So we have two imaginary atheists that are standing by that soup 3.7 billion years ago, and they're looking to each other, and they say, you know what? In that soup right there, without any intelligent input whatsoever, there's going to be strands, little strands, okay, that are going to evolve themselves into life. And some of that life is going to grow up to be you and me and to be able to actually contemplate their existence and evaluate their thoughts and come up with this great thing called religion and develop concepts like good and evil and invent for themselves a standard of morality and justice, and build themselves cities and airplanes. Look, it's just right down there in that soup. There's going to be nothing to it. There's going to be no intelligent designer needed. They're just going to evolve themselves. They're going to bump together, and things are going to happen, and chemical explosions are going to go off, and they're going to arrange themselves to the point that they can contemplate themselves. And then the guy next to him, the other atheist, says, yeah, that seems like the most reasonable course of action. That seems like, you know what? That is reasonable. Atheism is reasonable because of what you just said. And yet that is exactly what they teach, and that is exactly what they believe. And they will use fancy language to code it and cover it. And because of the fact that the Bible says that the human heart is depraved and wicked and seeks beyond all cost not only to deny the existence of God, but not to follow him if he does exist, because all those factors are there, we're just going to go ahead and we're going to apply our faith to go ahead and believe that. And that's just amazing to me. That they can actually, intelligent people, people way smarter than you and me, can actually spend their lives writing material and speaking that material and coming up with fancy ways to present atheism as if it were logical. And so the other side of that coin, belief in God is rational, while the application of that belief at certain times may be highly irrational, as Mike talked about last time. The application of that belief in God, we are called to walk by faith and not by sight. We are called to submit our wills to this unseen God who we can demonstrate exists logically, but sometimes our following of him may look illogical and may look irrational. But the underpinnings behind our following him, the intellectual, the rational, the philosophic, the scientific reasons why we follow this God indeed are rational and take a lot less faith to believe than what the atheist has to do. Thank you for your time, and I hope the Yankees won tonight. That would be a series with the Angels. We're going to beat the Angels this time. Question.
I'd like to make a comment.
Absolutely.
Just within the last few days, I heard discovered in the human brain that there's a section, they're able to isolate the section that allows a person to believe in God or a higher power, as they say. That in some people, the section is larger and some smaller. The ones with more of this are more able to think symbolically. So forth, but they also found that it had a very definite role in the growth of our civilization, formed societies, and all that. But the belief in God, actually, just the belief alone, is what allowed us to form together as societies.
That's interesting. There's been a lot of studies on trying to pinpoint human consciousness in the brain. And that's an interesting finding. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, they have not been able to pinpoint a certain part of the brain that makes up Jeff. You see what I mean? Like, they can't cut out, you know, they can't cut, okay, well, let me just take Jeff out. Let's see what we can do here, you know? I mean, if you lose a piece of pink matter, if you lose a finger, you lose an arm, or whatever the case may be, you still exist as a conscious Jeff. I mean, even if you're a vegetable, you know, chances are you still exist in there as Jeff. You know, we have the example of Peter, who just got into that motorcycle accident. My wife's cousin, cousin's fiance or whatever, and he was pretty close to brain dead, and was actually able to communicate, sort of, somewhat, fluttering eyelids and stuff, and now he can take paper and throw it at you and whatever the case may be. But the bottom line is that it's not necessarily any portion of your physicality that makes up your consciousness or your capacity for religious involvement or whatever the case may be. We have to look to a transcendent source for that input. Anything else? Yeah. All right, thank you for your time, and I was below a half an hour before your question, so I'm still below a half an hour. All right.